talking, is it?
What do we say now? Just speak a bit. No, what? What I was very keen to do was to hear, you know, something about the, when you really started out. We were talking about just now. Is this clear enough?
Oh, yes, it should be all right. Well, it started at Brighton when my parents had a house in Vernon Gardens.
Vernon Gardens.
And we had quite a big garage there.
Yeah.
Well, to go back even further than that, I was very interested in making gramophones out of cigar boxes when I was very young, by sticking a needle in the corner of a cigar box and mounting the thing up on some kind of arm. And he used to play a tune.
He used to play it.
Oh, ruinous to records, of course. But that was some mild experiment.
Yeah.
But in any case, the way the real business started, we decided to design a machine, and the first machine was actually made with long bits of wood with pen knives.
Who was that? You say we?
We. That was Ginn, E.M. Ginn, and myself.
Yeah. Was he living with you?
He was my elder brother.
Elder brother?
We were all living in the same house.
Oh,
right. But,
this would be when? This would be
1922.
Nice. But you already knew my father by then, surely, did you?
Ben and Lou.
Ben and Lou certainly knew, because I got a picture of them during the war, I think, or something, or just after the war.
I may have known him, I may not. I can't say.
It must have been earlier than that, because my father was injured, you know, and this picture I've got shows, I think it's probably Ben and Lou.
Yes.
With my father on a very old car in that garage. So it must have been a bit earlier. You know, that must have been during the war, I suppose. Would you think so?
Oh, yes, I must have known your father before that.
Mm-hmm.
Because, yes, he knew me when I was still at school.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
You see, yeah. We lived at Dulwich before we went to Vernon Gardens.
Yeah. I see.
Yeah. Yes, but the gramophone business started later.
Yes.
The garage business. You know about that one anyway.
Yeah. Oh, yes, I know about the garage. But
the gramophone business started after that.
You just decided, what, about 1922?
22.
You were fiddling about with garage.
But I'd been apprenticed to farming.
Yeah.
This is a little bit amusing.
Yeah, yeah.
Apprenticed to farming before that.
Yeah.
For a couple of years, first in Oxfordshire, and then about a year near Lewes.
Yeah. Yeah.
And at least the farmer in Oxfordshire told me, he said, David, the only farm you'll ever have will be in a flower pot, and that'll be full of weeds. Because he was right.
Yeah.
But I did like farming, really.
Yeah. Yeah.
But decided to try gramophones instead. And we really made this machine with tools like penknives and so on, and old bits of mahogany. And when we played,
that was you and Mike. Right?
You and Mike. It seemed so good. We decided to have something decent made.
It was good, was it?
Yes, it was so good. We made the whole, made the lot, except a sound box, which I think Henry Seymour made for us, one of the early experimenters and pioneers of gramophone. Unfortunately, they hardly mention him today, but he was one of the real pioneers, following on Edison. Seymour, who made a very nice machine of his own, marketed it. He lived in Camden Town, Road, I think it was, and he made a very nice machine called the Seymour Superphone, with a lovely ebonite horn, beautifully polished, lovely thing it was for its day, and he taught us quite a lot making gramophone. And he said he would make the sound box for us and put one of his tone arms on it.
How did you get into touch with him then? Did you know him or what?
Well, that's a tricky one to remember. I do remember going to his house.
Yeah.
And it was a marvellous place to go over because he had designs for...
He must have been living in Brighton.
No, he was living in London.
Oh,
I see. So I probably met Seymour before we moved to Brighton.
Yeah.
He was the one who probably fired enthusiasm for making gramophones. Because I remember going to his house, and he got a wonderful drawing. He used to do beautiful, scale drawings of a death ray machine. whether it would ever work or not, I don't know. I don't think he got that far. But it was a beautiful drawing, and he showed us these lovely gramophones he used to sell.
Yeah.
And another thing Seymour did, he used to get records, or say recorded by, in those days it was the Gramophone Company, or Columbia. He used to have a copying machine, which was very, very clever, to copy 78s. And he marketed records with a different label on them, with fake artists. And he was doing very well until they caught up on him. Of course, it was infringing the Copyright Act, and they stopped him.
Yeah.
But he made some very good records, but there were copies of 18. But he was a very, very clever man, was Henry Seymour. And he did a lot of experimenting on sound boxes. But in any case, this machine, the second one we had made by a cabinet maker, I never forget it. He delivered it to us unpolished, and we decided to polish it ourselves. It was a machine made of mahogany, and by the time we finished it, it was red as a tomato. You've never seen anything so red for a cabinet. But we set this thing up and put an advert in the Brighton Herald, I think it was. And we had shoals of people come along to hear this thing, and we took orders right and left. And one of them was the mayor of Brighton. I forget his name.
This is still what, be about 1922?
1922, the mayor of Brighton. Yeah. And not only that, the Brighton Herald sent one of their, reporters along. And they gave us a marvellous write-up in the Brighton Herald, Brighton Hove Herald. I wish we'd had a copy of that.
And you can get a copy.
But anyway, we made the first machine we delivered was made for the mayor of Brighton.
That was the first machine that you made. That was you.
The first one we delivered was made for the mayor of Brighton.
You probably did more of the making than mine. Yes,
that is so.
Yeah.
But he was the business head. Really.
Yeah.
Anyway, I'll never forget. It happened to be this first machine. It was finished. It looked like a tomato. And I remember the mayor saying, "It's extraordinary colours." He said, we put one over him. He said, "Oh, yes, that's the modern idea." we got away with it. And another funny thing happened then. We were playing this machine, we put a record on. I can remember the record. It was a record of Lalouette.
Who?
A thing called Lalouette.
Lalouette. Oh, I know, yes.
I think it's The Lark, is it? French,
yes,
the Lark.
That's right, yeah.
It was played by Frederick Lamont. And it was one of the nicest piano records of that day. We were playing this record, and there was an old dear sitting there. When it was all over, she asked us to put the piano record on again, which we did. And eventually she spoke up. She said, "Do you know," she said, "Oh, sorry, no, I'm wrong here. We played the piano, then she asked us to put a violin record on again, which we did." We put a violin record on, and she eventually spoke up. She said, "Do you know, I've just paid so many £100 for pianola, and it will not play violin at all." But she said, "This machine, only this price, will play both piano and violin."
But pianola, what a great thing, isn't it? Oh,
yeah, it's awful. Probably cost £200 or £300.
Yeah, but they were the great sort of thing. Yeah.
And it wouldn't play violin, she could play.
Good. What happened after that then? I mean, how did you come up into Frith Street?
We went to Hoven. Hoven.
I remember Hoven.
Well, I think it was then that my father took his house in Underhill Road, Dunwich.
Yeah.
Moved to Dunwich.
Can I sort of interrupt?
No, sorry, that must be wrong. I think Dunwich came before that. Must have done.
Did you actually make any more machines down at Brighton?
Oh yes, made several in this garage. Had the cabinets made out and put horns in them.
Yeah.
But
what kind of horns were they?
They were small square horns done by guesswork in the interior cabinet job, not the outside horn at all.
Oh,
they
I
came,
see. This is
they
all came,
the they came
cabinet
late.
Inside.
And, anyway,
but you'll excuse me for cutting in like this, but I mean, gramophones are pretty common in those days.
Oh, yes,
they?
Yeah, they're all acoustic ones.
But why were you able to sell this so easily? I mean, what was there anything different about this? Was it better quality or what?
Well, we thought so. We thought this sounded better than most. I'm not going to say they sound as good as Seymour's Super, but a big outside horn.
No, he had an outside horn, didn't he? Like the old HMV advertisement and things.
Well, I never considered that acoustic gramophone, where acoustic gramophones are concerned, the cabinet model sounded like as good as the horn, even in the old tin horn.
Yeah.
But as a cabinet machine, the table, well, it might have been a pedestal, I forget, or I think we did both, pedestal and table machine, they sounded as good as most, better than most, and as good as the best HMV. At half the price, you see, that's why we were doing so well.
Oh, I see, they were much cheaper.
They were much cheaper than HMVs. They used to be quite a high price.
Yes.
HMVs in those days. I'm not going to claim that our cabinet making was as good as HMV cabinets, because in my opinion.
You actually made the cabinet, did you?
Well, we did that first one.
Yeah. But after that, somebody else.
Well, we got a cabinet maker in Brighton. But HMV cabinet work in the early days was really beautiful.
Yeah.
Beautiful stuff.
Yeah.
So we never equaled the HMV cabinet, but we did beat that in the HMV sale. That's why we did so well at first. Anyway, we moved back to London. My father, I think it was Clapham we went to live at. Anyway, we moved back to London and I think it was Highgate. I think Clapham came before we moved to Brighton. I think it was Highgate. Yes, I remember going to Hope, where we had this upstairs office. I remember over Bourne and Tanks, the hose in Hope, and we had this one room and we worked from there.
When I can remember distinctly going to a party somewhere, probably Underhill Road, but when would that come in? Because I wasn't born until 1918. So that would have been probably sometime in the 20s, I would think. I could have been
Underhill Road might have been then.
I could have been more about five or six then.
It might have been Underhill Road before Highgate.
I would think myself, because I can distinctly remember. Do you know what sticks in my memory?
We were definitely in Brighton in 1922.
Shall I tell you what sticks in my memory? Bobbing for apples in a bowl of water.
It might be, yeah.
We did that there at the party, and there was something about it. And you had some apples also on some string.
That's right,
try to eat.
That's
them.
Right, that was
so I can remember it distinctly. Well, now, I know that we moved to Beckentry. I must have been about 8 or 9 when we went to Beckentry. So I could have been more about 6 or 7, I think, then.
Yes, well, what
would place
date?
It around about 1924, you see, 1925, that would place that roughly.
Yes, well, we probably went to Underhill Road, but wasn't there very long, you see.
Because I can still distinctly remember that.
That's right. I remember you're right, because I remember do you remember the Mayos being there, Sam and
Mayo? Yes,
that's
right. Mayo, the name, that name is quite familiar,
right.
Yes.
They were sons of Sam Mayo, the famous comedian.
Ah, yes, that name is very familiar.
And that was
Mayos, I remember that.
Yes, that must have been, because we got very friendly with the Mayos, and I must have been getting on for 20 there.
Yes. Well, that would place it about right, wouldn't it, 19 or 20?
Yes. So that must have been after, we must have come to Underhill Road.
Yes, sounds like
Dulwich. And then on to
Highgate, yes.
But I think the boys had the garage before then.
I think they must have done,
They
must have done. My father never told me how they finally disposed their garage, and I didn't realise that your father bought there. I never knew that.
Yes.
It's quite new to me.
Yes, they did. Ben and Lou ran it.
I certainly got a photograph at home, as you say, probably of Ben and Lou. I've got that one on.
Yes, the aeroplane stayed there for some little time. Do you remember the aeroplane in the garage?
No, I can't remember that. I can't remember the garage itself at all.
Yeah, actually had that aeroplane that he flew at Blackpool in the garage.
I don't think I was
I remember seeing that.
Yeah, I don't think I was alive.
You see, I remember seeing that, so we must have known your dad, and his father.
Yeah, yeah.
Before the date, I'm saying, yes, I was only a schoolboy when I remember that aeroplane.
I wonder what happened to the aeroplane.
I don't know.
It was a monoplane, wasn't it?
Yes.
It must have been the first monoplane in England.
Yes, it was in that garage. And it was in that garage where Ben and Lou were still.
Ben and Lou would probably remember what happened to that, but it'd be interesting to track it down. Oh, I suppose somebody probably threw it away for junk or something.
Yeah, it's pitiful. But anyway, we went to Holborn. And ran from there, and in the meantime...
You must have taken a shop or something at home, then.
Yes,
Your father decided to back it.
It was a first floor.
Yeah. Oh, first floor?
It was a first floor. It was really supposed to be just an office to be used as a workshop.
Your father backed you then, did he?
No, my father never really backed us financially. You know? We had to make our own way.
Did you?
He used to pay me a bit of pocket money until I started earning. I mean, he wasn't like that.
You couldn't have been making much out of it, though,
didn't you? No, I was making a small wage, that's what I was getting.
You were selling enough of those machines. Were you actually making enough by the time you moved to Holborn?
Yes. I remember one week you turned out 17.
17?
Yes.
How did you turn out 17?
No, that must have been after the garage business, because when the boys got out of the garage, Ben came to work with us for a while.
Oh.
You see, so I know that's the later date in the garage business. Yeah. So we must have known your father, I think, before we started up the gravel. At least Ben and Lou.
I can't remember whether my father was an army teacher. That would fix the date. Well, he always used to hide that, you know. It's very funny. It's a little quirk, I suppose. But when you ever had a photograph taken, that arm, he'd always sort of keep it back there. But you could tell from the photograph whether his arm was injured or not. It's just a curious little psychological trait, you know.
But Lou would be the one to know that. But anyway, at Holborn, we got to know Percy Wilson. He was then technical editor of the gramophone.
Yeah.
Or at least I don't think they called him technical editor, he was technical advisor or something.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, Percy Wilson, in my opinion, did more for the modern gramophone, the electrical reproducer, than any man really living. Because he set the stage for what had been developed. He was the originator, he was the original one that discovered such enormous errors in tracking of early gramophone, and redesigned pickup arms and early tone arms to track properly.
Yeah.
He didn't invent the logarithmic horn, but he developed it to a stage that, the EMG and expert gramophones were founded on his early experiments. If it hadn't been for Percy Wilson, those machines I don't think would ever come about.
How did you get to know him? Is it just for mutual interest in gramophones or something like that?
Percy Wilson was interested in the work we were doing. And he liked the way we went about things.
He just heard about you, did he?
He knew about us because we advertised in the gramophone. We advertised in either the first or the second issue of the gramophone, and that went on for years and years, non-stop. And Percy Wilson also doing things for the gramophone. He was always interested in all the advertising, but he seemed to be particularly interested in us because he liked the way we went about things. And he helped us know it. I mean, he even designed the horn part for some of the early cabinet machines.
Were you actually making those big horns by then or not? Where did that start?
Those big horns were first.
Yeah.
There was a first Wilson, which was a long, straight horn designed to replace the horn on HMV gramophone. It was made to fit the body,
take the old tin horn away,
put this great papier-mâché horn.
Yeah.
And our first horn machine, we made machines to take that horn. And we sold any number of them.
Yeah.
And then it was decided, well, bigger horns and more not sticking out so far would be a nicer thing.
Yeah.
And we redesigned horns, founded on the Wilson idea of logarithmic form.
Logarithmic.
Shape with an S bend. Now, those first machines, although I shouldn't harp on too much of this one, the original idea came from Gill and myself, but to work the mathematics out, we were helped by a Mr. Davey, who later on became manager of EMG.
You were saying, though, that Percy Wilson thought up the idea of the horn, but then you just now said that you and Mike worked something out.
Yes. This was for the bigger horn, the original one.
You decided to improve the Percy Wilson horn.
Or have a bigger horn than Percy Wilson.
A bigger one.
Whether it was an improvement or not, well, that's debatable.
But you two decided.
Because the Wilson horn was straighter, less bended.
But you, the you bigger can't remember now why you decided.
Yes, to get bigger bass, better bass. Bigger horns give better bass. That was the real idea behind it. And then the horn with the big S bend came out. But the mathematics were done by David.
Yeah, yeah.
And
right.
Yes. Of course, with the development of horn, there's also parallel to a development of the sound box.
Yes, yes.
And there again, Percy Wilson did a lot of early experiments with sound boxes, and he taught us an awful lot. Yes. But the one man that never gets mentioned today, I think he was a Russian refugee. The name of Virz, V-I-R-T-Z, who used to make superb sound boxes. But it was only after a good deal of experimenting that Percy Wilson, in company with another person we know, Harry Wilde, they used to get together and suggest this and that. That eventually, I forget if it was Percy Wilson one day walked up with a marvellous sound box, or it was Harry Wilde, I forget which one it was, but one or the other walked up with a sound box to really beat them all. And after a while told us the secrets of this sound box, and we incorporated it in our makes.
Wasn't patented or anything? No patent.
That type, you see, that anybody could do this willingly. We seem to be the only one working in that category that would take on fiddling with sound boxes like that. Because even in those days, the majority of sound boxes were mass-produced.
Yeah.
They just put together with a few screws, and that was that. But the better sound boxes needed what they call tuning.
Yeah.
It's been partly tightening up one screw, loosening another, and so on, until you got the right sound. And the tuning of the sound box was done by ear, and it wanted somebody knew what they were listening to do it.
Yeah.
So the mass producers wouldn't have anything to do with this type of manufacture.
It gave a much better sound.
Oh, it did. Oh, undoubtedly.
Yeah.
But I did some experimenting on sound boxes myself, but I won't claim to have invented anything astounding like Percy Wilson and Harry Wilde.
Yeah. I remember those early sound boxes you had, in Frith Street, and earlier still than that. A sort of brass thing. It's difficult to describe now, but I can clearly remember that. But we had one at home, didn't we?
I still get one too to repair,
It still work all right.
Yeah, people still using acoustic gramophones for acoustic records.
I suppose that's where my father came in, wasn't it? Because I remember him messing about with those sound boxes. He was always cat.
That's right.
And then he'd play a bit, and he had one or two favourite records, I think, that he used to like to play. And I'm sure that, I think that Elgar Violin Concerto or the Elgar Cello Concerto that he used to seem to be playing quite frequently anyway.
Well, this tapping, you see, and getting used to playing a certain record, is the tuning of the quality of the tapping.
Yeah. Yes, I can remember that.
Gave you an idea of how good the sound box was. But your father, I remember rightly now, he used to help me an awful lot in making a sound box.
Yes.
Because we got so many orders for that I couldn't cope with them myself. And the amount of repairs, sound box repairs, was colossal, really. People used to bend the diaphragms or crack them according if they had mica. But that was another development. I think we were the probably the first ones to bring it to the notice in general of the superior quality of aluminium as a diaphragm over mica.
They're using all mica over there.
They were all mica, laminated mica. But a man by the name of Mr. Byrne, should bring all these early names in, really.
Yes,
because they hardly get mentioned, right, they're forgotten. A man by the name of Mr. Byrne came to us one day and said, I'm able to make these, would you like to try one? And it was an aluminium diaphragm. And we almost laughed at him, what? Do one with mica? He said, you try one and see. And when we tried one, it was far superior to the mica, gave a livelier sound, fuller. And from that day, Burton used to make these aluminium diaphragms.
Just like that. Why should he suddenly come on you with an aluminium diaphragm?
Well, he'd been experimenting on these things, pressing rings into them to get the right tension. And he probably picked on us as being the best people to test the thing.
He was just interested, presumably, in sound, perhaps? Or
yes, he knew a good sound. And he wanted our opinion, well, we've got the right line.
Was he an amateur then? He was an amateur. I see.
But he made these things very well, professionally,
so eventually
we employed him.
Yeah.
And he made them on the premises.
Really?
Showed us how to do it. And
where did my father sort of come into this?
Well,
when did you, who first decided to employ him or use him?
It's very, very difficult. He came in regularly after we started Expert Gramophone.
When did that actually begin?
Now, that was about 1929. You see, this...
whose idea was that? Was it just Mark's idea? Or Mike King?
To start again?
To start sort of under that label, Expert. What were you trading under before then?
Well, it's interesting to go back a bit.
Yeah.
The original name, when we started in 1922,
that would be a Brighton.
You would call it the Magnifone Company, which it's a name that sounds corny today.
Yeah.
But in those days, it was a jolly good name.
Yeah.
But we ran for about a year under that name, and we suddenly got a letter from some old boy who got a gramophone business in City Road, saying that it was a colourable imitation of one of his registered names. You've got a sound box registered under that name, the name of Magnifone. And we were using Magnifone. And he called it a colour of imitation. And we got to stop. Or else he would sue us. You see, so we had Henry Seymour had to be this man named Louis Young. And Henry Seymour happened to be a friend of Louis Young's and very friendly with us. So we got on to Seymour and said to Seymour, well, Louis Young's kicking up about this, what do we do? He said, oh, we won't sue you. He said, I'll go and have a word with you. So Seymour had a word with Louis Young, and he phoned us back to say that Louis Young is willing to drop action, providing we change the name. So my brother said, well, I know what we'll do. Use my initials. Nobody can stop us doing that. And that's how EMG came into being, because his initials mean Ellis Michael Ginn. So we called it EMG Gramophone. And that was the start. Now, in 1929, this man who we took money from,
we
did take money, we accepted his money to help us run it, wanted bigger production. And it came to a good old bastard. I'll tell you, outcome of that. The bastard, and there was a split case. And we started again and called it Expert Gramophones, which we thought was another name far removed from anybody else. But it was really due to your father if I remember rightly, that we did start again, because Mike was very despondent over it, and your father said, oh, you're good enough to start designing again, there's room for two of you, which we did, and there was room, although we were fighting our own made opposition. And of course, we never really built up Export Gramophones, what we did EMG. But it did all right.
Oh, yes, I remember. Export Gramophones very well indeed.
Yeah.
I mean, you had some pretty tremendous customers in those days. Yeah. You just mentioned T. Shaw, well, T. Lawrence, rather.
The Delius machine was an EMG.
That was Lawrence. Before you split up, though, wasn't it?
Yes. The Lawrence one was next.
Who were you, when you say you split up there, I mean, who split from who? You can tell me that all right.
We split from EMG.
Was Percy Wilson running EMG?
No. We were running it at the time.
Yeah.
But we had a manager. Well, the manager was left behind. And a certain amount was paid out for Ginn's name. Because the money that was really running the business, it's Mr. West.
So he sort of took over EMG.
He took over EMG. And he
did he want his money back then? Was that it? No, he just wanted his money back? Or
no. Well, he by agreement, he took over and paid so much for the name, which helped to start again.
Yeah.
But there's more to it.
Yes.
I'll tell you.
Oh, yes. All right.
But, anyway, this man Dave took over control.
Yeah.
But we started again with you know, like advice from your father or help. Mm. You know,
was he actually working for EMG or
no? No, he didn't. No, I forget what he was doing. Whether he was running the court business then or not.
No,
what I mean by backing, by encouraging.
Yes, I can understand that.
He really encouraged us to start again.
But was he, you were still friendly with him, you knew him.
Oh, yeah.
Did you meet regularly, or?
He used to come up to Frith Street occasionally, have a chat and so on.
You just knew each other as friends, presumably, I suppose.
But if I remember right, before he came to us, he had a little warehouse or something where he used to keep his cork mats and cork and so on.
That cork mat business, I believe, was something to do with a British Legion or something, wasn't it?
I've got no idea that far.
Disabled servicemen or something. Disabled ex-servicemen, something started him up in that, I think.
Oh, yes. But like anyway, he did have a little warehouse.
Mm-hmm.
But when he found out, we told him we got a little room to spare, I think he moved over to us in order to save money on this warehouse, you see, to do without it. And at the same time, any little thing he could do for us in his spare moments, he could do it. And by George, he was handy too. Because even with his one hand, he knew how to use a screwdriver.
Yes.
He knew the mechanics of it.
Yes.
And he knew how to listen.
Of course, he would have been a skilled mechanic. He knew a lot about cars. A great deal from his father, obviously.
Yeah.
But of course, he must have.
Oh, no, he was skilled. He was a right hand. He used to assemble these sound boxes. Marvellous.
When did you sort of decide to sort of take him on full time? Was your business growing?
Yes, not only that. His cult business didn't do too well. And he thought it was better to shut that down if we could give him a job.
Now.
Yeah,
that was the start of the Spanish Civil War.
That was it.
Yes, that's
right. Somebody
the supplies of cork diminished rapidly.
That's right. I knew something.
That's right. I remember that now.
And
put pay to his cork net business. Yeah. I remember that very well. He couldn't get supplies properly from Spain, where most of his cork was coming.
So he came to work for full time for us, making fiber needles, sound boxes, or whatever, assembly machine.
It would be right then. I can remember, this must have been a machine remember.
Yes.
But my father was experimenting with gramophones then.
Could be.
Because I can still remember him making this large, squarish plywood horn. He was bending it, steaming the plywood and bending it, and nailing it very carefully together with panel pins and things.
That's right.
And it was quite a large sort of horn when it finished, and it had a decided, what looked like, I suppose, a logarithmic curve to it.
Was that the one fitted with a loudspeaker?
No, this was a horn, an actual horn. He had got, but I think that was much later, that would have been much later. Probably when we were at Chi. That would have been much later.
The loudspeaker.
He had that loudspeaker thing in a big baffle. But this plywood horn, I can distinctly remember that, and I thought it was much earlier than that.
Because I've got some recollection of that, you know, being done for somebody or other.
I had a feeling that I think
he made that up to special order or something.
Could be.
I think we had a special order, he got to fit into some fireplace or other.
Might have been.
And he took the making, because he got quite clever at bending the stuff, you know.
It's interesting, though.
Yeah, I think he made several of those square loudspeakers made out of hardboard, a kind of hardboard.
Yes, I can remember that.
They used to make them paint.
Yes, that's right. I do remember vividly, though, the appalling stink. When he was cooking these fibre needles, he used cook them in a brown kind of
treat.
Yes, he called it treating them. I think he was trying to harden them.
That's right, harden.
Whether it was successful or not.
It did. It made a little bit.
Did it?
Oh,
right. I remember him doing it on the kitchen stove. That must have been quite. I'm sure that was before sort of 36, before he was actually working full time for you, but I don't know.
It could have been. That could have run at the same time as he was running the cork business.
Yes, I think he must have been.
I think he used to, when we really pushed, that's when he used to make some at home too.
Who first thought of this idea of fire? Where did that come from? Because that was, after all, quite important, wasn't it?
Yes, I couldn't say exactly who. Because I know in the very early days, HMV used to sell fiber needles. Not thorns, they came later.
Yes.
The prickly pear thorns, that came later. But who started those, I would say? But who invented the fibre needle? It's difficult to say, because the very early HMV gramophones were made to take fibre.
Were they?
They weren't very successful.
I thought they all used steel needles.
No, not all the time. Steel came first.
Yeah.
But then fibre needles came out for those people who wanted to preserve their record. But the HMV machine, or the big producers, their machines wouldn't play fibre needles properly, although they sold them.
Yeah.
But the fibre needles we used to make by hand were much tougher and rather larger than the old HMV ones.
I think I've seen those old fibre needles. Yeah. They were thinner and round, I think. They didn't have that hard edge, and whether they were actually made of bamboo. Yours were made of bamboo. Because I can still remember my father sawing those rings out of a large piece of bamboo. He used to saw them with a hacksaw about an inch wide.
Cut them off with a knife.
Yeah. Well, he used a chisel originally. I can remember that very well. He was always doing that at home, I can remember that. And he was doing them up in packets, I suppose. It must have been, 50 would have been a packet?
It's about that.
Yes, he was doing them up in packets. And then he started this business of doping them, I think, or treating them.
Well, the first people who used, I think there again, I think Percy Wilson was one of the first to experiment on dope for fibre. In the early days, anybody who wanted to look after their records wouldn't put a steel needle on.
No, they wore the records out very rapidly, didn't they?
Yeah, either fibres or salt.
Yes.
Now, to play fibres properly, they must have one of these special sound boxes, like a Vips or a Wild one of ours, But later on, then the thorn needles came out. But I never thought the thorn needles quite as good as the fibre. I don't think so. I don't think they held up so well.
Because the beauty of fibre needle was that you could cut a new point.
Well, the sharpness for the thorns too.
Were they?
Yeah.
Sharpener.
A sharpener. Rub the point on a piece of revolving sandpaper.
More laborious than that little cutter you use for those fibre needles.
those fiber needles gave very good sound, didn't
they? They did. They did it. If you tune the sound box to suit the fire, they gave even a better quality, I think, than steel needle, because they didn't produce the background scratch.
Oh, yes, it's a much better sound. Because I remember as a boy listening to Mozart's 39th Symphony on fiber needles. And even to this day, I remember it was very acceptable, very, very good sound indeed.
One of the snags with these, what I call the commercial mass-produced sound boxes, the movement was so stiff that only play about half a record, you've got to sharpen the point again. They kept breaking down. Now, the better sound boxes, if they were balanced nicely, you know, paint to balance the machine, they sometimes play two or three sides before they broke down.
Eventually, you had an awful lot of customers, though, didn't you? A great name, it seems to me. I remember in the window, I think it was Fifth Street, there was a board with letters on.
Yes, in my opinion, that was a mistake to publicise all these famous people.
But they had letters or something with the postmarks on or something like that, from all over the world.
Well, I mean, unfortunately, all those letters got destroyed, you know. But we had a list of people we supplied, like reading to Brett, really.
I can remember my father going all the way up to Compton Mackenzie's house once.
Yes.
Presumably that was to either install a machine or sell it.
Well, that might have been Scotland.
It was Scotland, Bewley Firth.
That's right, yeah, the little island.
That's right, in the middle of Bewley Firth.
The name went something like Eileen Avis, the name of the island. I don't know if you could find it on the map.
You can do, yes. I've got a map of that large scale map.
It was in the mouth of Bewley.
Yes, that's right, I remember that.
Oh, it was a lovely place. I went up there too.
Did you? What was the idea of that then? Did you just, was this just
to install this machine?
But installed it wasn't much, really, was it?
Not in those days, no. But we used to make sure this sounded right and so on.
I thought you got paid for going all that way.
During the war, you had a small cottage on Hampstead Heath. We put in machines there. So.
Who else did you have? Lord Berners, I think.
Lord Berners, yes.
You've already mentioned Lawrence and T. Shaw, T. Lawrence rather, and Shaw, the aircraft and Shaw. Delius, Frederick Delius.
Made a machine for the Duke of Gloucester.
Oh, Duke of Gloucester, you mentioned. Yeah. Who else was there? A lot of other people.
Oh, a lot of other people. Lord Moyne. Only a few years back.
Oh, Lord Moyne, he was the.
Guinness.
Wasn't he something to do with Egypt? Was he viceroy of Egypt?
Might have been.
I can't remember now. But Guinness family, were they? You sent a lot aboard, didn't you? Maharaja or...
Oh, yeah.
Baroda, was it? Or?
Might have been. I forget a lot of these names. Since I've been down here, I've been along to attend to the Earl of Oxford.
No.
I shouldn't mention all these names.
Well, it doesn't matter.
So be careful which one. Well, it works in a closed circle.
Oh, this is nothing to do with anybody. This is
if you give them a talk.
Oh, I wouldn't. If there's any doubt about anything at all, I'd send it to you first.
With these people, what they want to do with these forms, but they don't like being mentioned.
But some people you could mention
Lawrence because his machine's been published.
Yes, and he's long dead anyway. But to say that you've sold a machine to some people doesn't mean anything at this stage. It's such a long time ago anyway. And really speaking, apart from the, I suppose, the interest factor, I can't see that there's great anything to worry about there at all. I mean, it's such a long time ago. They're all old hat, they're all old fashioned out of date things now anyway, you know. But I was just curious, because I do remember that you had a very wide
yeah.
Were there any other composers? Oh,
I think one or two musicians.
What about Constant Lambert? Did he have
Osborne? The
Sitwells. Yes.
I've been to Sitwell's place. A rather interesting.
I think my father used to know Sir Cheval Sitwell.
That's right. He did.
I don't know how well he knew him, but...
Well, we made a horn machine for Sir Chapman Sitwell. But it's rather interesting, he used to send us a card. Please will you send someone to all my gramophones? had to go all the way. That was a useful little card. Well, my grammar. You used to have to go all the way up to Tasker just to adjust this, just this grammar for it, make sure it was well oiled and so on. But I remember going. Chock a block of records, all beautifully fine. And wrote together the list of the records taken, all and it was beautifully done. On the in the corner of the island, there was a pile of broken records. Nearly a part might have been cut to pieces. On the table, alongside the machine, there was an unpacked record already for the child. And you could visualize what happened. He put these records in the machine, played them. If he didn't like it, whip it off and throw it in the corner, just like that. If he liked it, it was carefully passed. You can even see that.
Yeah.
I've never seen such a pile of broken records.
Well, because they were very brittle in those days, weren't they, records? That's another thing, of course, records. I mean, they only used to play for about 5 minutes, or something like that, didn't they? Of course, you'd need an awful lot of record, I suppose, for any of the major works, really. It's remarkable how well they did play. When did you finally abandon the horn type of machine, Mary? It must have been just before the war,
I think. I think they went right up to the war.
Did they?
Yeah.
The horn machine.
Yes, because they were overlapping with the others. Some people wouldn't have anything to do with it.
The electrical machines were coming in then, surely.
Oh, they were. They started coming in.
You mentioned just now the moving coil, sound box.
I remember a machine coming from America.
Yeah.
I forget the make of it. Might have been Magnavox. I think they were in existence then. But anyway, I heard this thing and it got an enormous bass.
Mm.
Well, as you know, Compton Mackenzie was so keen on music and reproduced music at that. He was so interested in the gramophone. So the story goes that he heard one of these new electrical machines and the sound impressed him to such a degree it made him ill. I mean, it didn't make him ill because he would dislike the sound.
No.
The shock of it.
Excessive excitement.
Perhaps. Yeah. Made him ill, they had to take him back to Jeddah on a stretcher.
To where?
Jeddah, he had the island of Jeddah, the Channel Islands there.
Oh, it changed over from...
Of course, that story might have been exaggerated, taking him back on a stretcher, but apparently it did. It made him ill, the excitement of hearing this thing.
So that was obviously, they were obviously coming in just before the war, anyway. But that was really, that was just the beginning of the electronic era.
Yeah.
So around, 1937, 1938, was it?
Because while I think of it, there's an interesting story about Mackenzie and Christopher Stone.
Christopher Stone was another person.
It's generally accepted that Christopher Stone was the first disc jockey.
Yes, yeah.
But to me, that is not quite true. Compton Mackenzie was the first disc jockey. And after his first show, he had so many letters of appreciation that he didn't know how to deal with them. And at that time, Christopher Stone, who was Compton Mackenzie's brother, was looking for a job. And Compton Mackenzie said, "Here you are, you take over this radio business from me." He said, "There's a ready-made job for you." Christopher Stone took over from Compton Mackenzie and made such a success of it, it's generally accepted that Christopher Stone was the first disc jockey.
He was a household name before the war, Christopher
it was
Stone.
Compton Mackenzie,
yeah. He was, wasn't you? Remember, I remember Christopher Stone very well.
But
he wrote a lot for the gramophone too,
well,
didn't he?
I mean, if you use any of this, you know, sift it. He was joint editor of the gramophone, he became. But We used to call him Bodo Dio Stone.
Yes, I know.
Because,
I remember that.
Because he used to play mostly classical records.
Yes.
But he used to glean his information out of the HMV catalogue. He used to talk about the record, the artist.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's where he got it from, because we used to think that he, musically, he hadn't got much music in it.
Yes,
but he used to get it, because HMV in those days used to issue a lovely thick catalogue with the history of the artist, the history of the music, you get it all out of the
catalogue. Well, that's fair enough, anyway.
And he used to get it, they'd talk about it.
I mean, most people wouldn't know anything.
But he used to do it so well.
Mm. Mm. He was very good.
He became a famous name.
Yes, he was a household good. Yeah. That's all the name before the war, isn't it? Anyway, indeed. Christmas Day.
Right. Well, they accepted him as the first disc jockey, but I think Compton Mackenzie was the one who started that.
It's really interesting, really. Harking back to these early days, that story. I suppose the war finished you off, did it? I mean, why did it pack up? Could
well,
you not kept going on?
I kept going during the war, did best it? I could.
Yeah.
With regard to myself, it was rather interesting. I joined the Warden Service before the war came out. And they trained me as a district warden.
Yeah.
And I became an incident officer. Well, anyway, when the war started, somehow or other, the authorities got to learn that I knew a bit about radio. So I had a notice to attend some Air Force depot who were hard up for radio technicians. And they put certain questions in front of me, I answered, and they put a circuit diagram, will you explain the circuit diagram, which I did, and so on. So eventually I had a letter from the town clerk, who was really, in those days, head of the Warden Service, the town clerk was, of that particular area. And he said to me, he said, the RAF want to take you from us, you know. He said to me, do you want to go? He said, let me go, you see. So I threw it back at him. I said, he said to me, he said, your training has cost us an awful lot, you know. He said, we don't want to lose you. He said, do you want to go to the RAF? I said, I leave that to you. I said, you're the one who are the heads running this war. If you think I'll be more service to you, I'll stay. If you think I want to go into the RAF, I will go. I said, I'm not choosing one way or the other.
Yeah.
He said, well, in that case, he said, we'll keep you. So, well, being in the war service locally,
yes.
I was able to do a little bit of carrying on. I could keep things together, which I did throughout the war.
What happened to Mike Ginn?
Well, Mike Ginn. He,
I mean, presumably
he loved the services. During the First World War, became an army major. In the Second World War, he joined the Navy. At least they called him up. He was on the reserve. He wouldn't give up being a military man. He was on the reserves, and they called him up. And he went into the Navy. I forget what rank. I know he was an officer in the Navy. I don't think he became a captain, because he's a big boy. No, he was a captain in the Army, that's right, but I don't think they offered him a captaincy in the Navy, because the captain in the Navy...
Oh, he's a colonel.
Oh, he's a very big boy.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
He's in charge of a ship.
That's right. Yeah.
Well, he wasn't, but they really took him on. I think he went into the intelligence service, but did a sideline of training riflemen, teaching them how to use a rifle, because he was a terrific
rifle
shooter.
Oh, yes, that was his great hobby, wasn't it?
That's
rifle shooting, I remember that.
Wonderful rifle
shooter. I went out with him one day when I was quite young. I must have been a schoolboy, I think, up to Tring in Hertfordshire. And he was shooting rabbits with a 2.2 rifle and a telescopic sights and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And in those days there were thousands of rabbits there. I always remember we got up really early one morning, and it must have been about 6 o'clock in the morning. We lay on the bank of a field with these thousands of rabbits.
And he used to pick them up.
That's right, yes, he was very good indeed. He was shooting right, left and centre. Yes, I always remember that. I remember that very well.
But anyway, that was his sideline in the Navy too, mm-hmm. teaching, I think it was teaching officers how to mm-hmm. use the rifle. So he was away throughout the whole of the war, but I managed to do a little bit to keep the business alive.
You were doing it from your home, presumably. You were still living at Hyde.
Home at Hyde.
Mm. You'd shut down the shop in Prestley. Did you have to shut it down soon after the war began?
Yes. Yes, because when Gim went away, so yeah. I couldn't run it on my own.
Yeah.
And I had to do something for the war.
What happened to my father then? I suppose he sort of laid him off or something, did you?
Yes. Well, then I don't know.
Well, he became air aid warden in Cheese or something down there, but he got fed up down there, didn't he? Bum right and left down there. His health began to suffer a bit. He was getting no sleep. Like so many people in those days, he was too conscientious, I think, and he was getting no sleep.
Yeah.
And eventually his health was getting very bad, and that was when he decided to leave Cheese and come up to the quieter parts of Oxfordshire. And after some peregrinations around Banbury, they settled down at Banbury itself there. Where I sort of came back after the war to Banbury. That's how we left London.
I forget if he made five of these articles after he went to Banbury. I've got some feeling he did.
Well, I would make know that.
Maybe to send them up.
He was probably making them still, I think, at on there. Is that on there? Is it turning?
It's going. So. Not long after we split up, we started Expert Grammar Friends. A very well-known school in Highgate.
Yeah.
I don't think I mentioned which one. I can't probably remember which one. It was a famous school in Highgate. Bought an EMG machine.
Yeah.
They hadn't had it long, so we were told. When the tone went all muffled. They complained to EMG about it. EMG came along, collected it, examined it, said they couldn't find anything wrong with it, and returned it. Well, they got fed up with this and came to us. Said, "Well, we have a look at it for you."
Yes.
Well, we went along, at least I did, I went along, listened to this thing, and I said, "Yes, I don't think it sounds as good as ours by a long way." I said, "Would you like me to bring along one of ours and compare it?" Which I did. That one said, "Well, how much will you allow for this old EMG, although it wasn't very old, couple of years, against a new Expert?" Well, I exchanged it for a very small amount, just a few pounds off it for the EMG, delivered the Expert, and took the EMG back into our workshop. I thought, I must get to the bottom. I'm sure this thing didn't sound as bad as this when it was made. When I examined it, I took the horn off and the conduit. When I turned the conduit upside down, about a dozen table tennis balls came out of it. They got the thing in thing set up in a gymnasium where the children had. I think it was about four table tennis tables.
Yeah, they've probably been throwing them down there, anyway. Yeah. I'm knocking them in.
So we got, when we cleared the balls out of the thing, it sounded first class. So it was almost an payment exchange. Got it for just a few pounds.
Extraordinary.
An almost new machine. But the thing that surprised me, that they sent it back to EMG. I mean, if you use this to do it, they sent it back to EMG, and EMG returned it as being they could find nothing wrong with it.
That's impressive.
Another funny little incident. A titled lady, I forget which one it was, one of our regular clients, she brought one of these HMP portables in one day. You know, a soundbox portable. She said, "They've gone all muffled." Well, we put a record on, and it was certainly muffled, but it was obvious there was something stuffed down the hall.
Yeah.
I put my hand inside, out came a pair of gloves, which she absolutely astonished me. She said, "Good heavens, that's where they were." She said, "I've been looking for days for those gloves, and I couldn't look."
How did they get down a thing like that? Quite extraordinary.
We got down the hall.
Quite extraordinary. I was just curious about...
cured the fault straight away.
I was just curious. Old Mike Ginn, I used to like him, what I saw of him. Of course, I didn't see as much of him like I said you did on the bar. But was he very musically inclined?
I wouldn't say very.
No, it always seemed to me that you were the backbone of that business, it always seemed to me. I don't know. I mean, obviously, one can't exist without the other. But it did seem to me that...
He did a lot of books. He was a very good sound.
Uh-huh. That counts as something.
Yes. He could sell very well, obviously, at all.
You know, I always had a feeling...
Sometimes, he used to sell in such a way that he used to embarrass me. I just couldn't do it, but he sold the stuff.
I always had the feeling that you were the sort of musical side of the whole enterprise. He was the business side, right? But you were the musical side.
I used to leave it to me to decide. Yeah.